So in healing from the trauma I went through due to childhood sexual abuse and sibling sexual abuse, I was encouraged to do as much reading and research as I could to understand what it was and the whys. Not the why me, but why would someone do this? Why did it have the effect on me that it did? This is some of the research that I want to share with you today is what I learned in reading up on abuse. Every 9 minutes, someone is sexually assaulted in North America, or a child is sexually assaulted in North America. Every 68 seconds in general, someone is assaulted. In Holland, it is estimated that there are approximately 2 to 3 victims in every classroom. Before the age of 15, 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are abused. Less than 25 victims share about the abuse they went through within the first year. Half of them wait 5 years to disclose the abuse, and the majority of abuse cases are never disclosed at all. The majority of abuse cases are never reported to the authorities, and those that are reported, only 1 in 5 actually move forward with prosecution, and less than half of those result in a guilty plea. This means that only approximately 25 out of 1,000 perpetrators end up in prison for the crimes they committed. On that note, only 1% or less than 1% of childhood cases of sexual abuse are actually false. So the majority of them, no child will lie about the abuse they went through. That changes, however, in later years. Most perpetrators are rarely strangers. They are also not only men. Up to 20% of perpetrators lately are female. 30 to 40% of abuse is perpetrated by an extended family member. 50% are in people in a position of trust. This means family, friends, pastors, teachers, school workers, etc. The latest is research has shown that 40 to 70% of juveniles are actually of sexual abuse is done by juveniles, with the majority of them being siblings or teenagers that are close to a family. One of the most underreported forms of abuse is sibling sexual abuse, which is done by a sibling with less than or more than 2 years difference between the age of the perpetrator and the age of the victim. There are two different kinds of sexual abuse. One is contact sexual abuse and the other is non-contact sexual abuse. Non-contact sexual abuse is when a perpetrator encourages a child to masturbate or watch others masturbate, exposes the child to sexual acts, including adult pornography, exposes them to child abuse material, or invites a child to sexual touching, whether online or offline. They also communicate through technology, using means to commit sexual offenses, which in other words is sexting. They also tend to voyeuristically observe or record a child doing sexual acts, and also ask sexually intrusive questions or make explicit comments in front of a child. Purposely exposing genitals to a child is also another form of non-contact sexual abuse. Contact sexual abuse involves touching or fondling a child's genitals, a child's breasts, and even kissing them on the mouth. Another form is encouraging or forcing a child to touch either theirs or another child's genitals. Forced sexual acts on a child, including intercourse of any kind. In understanding perpetrators, there are two different kinds of perpetrators. One is a pedophile and the other is a sexual abuser. A pedophile is where an adult is sexually attracted to a child that is prepubescent. Sexual abusers are people that perpetrate abusive behaviors on another person. Not all pedophiles are sexual abusers, and not all sexual abusers or childhood sexual abusers are pedophiles. Studies are actually being done to show that a pedophile, there is a difference in the gray matter of the brain, and the gray matter is what enables individuals to process information and interpret data. And they're finding that the gray matter in a brain of a pedophile is actually different than a regular person. And this means that They can't always control their desires and their attraction. However, they can control what they do with these actions. My therapist had actually given me the example when she was working in a clinic that a pedophile had come to her and said, I have these urges, I feel I need to act on them, but I know that what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling is wrong. What can I do? And they had actually put this person on beta blockers, and a beta blocker is similar to what medication that you would give to someone with schizophrenia. However, in this case, it is actually a chemical castration for a person. This pedophile had actually gained a bunch of weight on these medications. However, he looked at it and he says, you know what, I don't care how much weight I gain. I know I'm not acting on my urges because I know they're wrong and I know they're going to hurt people. So he was okay with that weight gain because he knew that he was saving a child. Not all pedophiles have that same mental capacity to turn away from their urges. Sexual abusers are not always sexually attracted to their victims and do not have a need for intimacy. Most of them are seeking a sexual relationship that they can control and manipulate. And a child is quite honestly the easiest target and the most likely to be kept silent. There's two different types of sexual abusers. The predatory sexual offenders premeditate their abuse. They fantasize about their interactions with children. They view child porn, they seek jobs where they have access to children, and they carefully select their victims and groom them into submission. Most of these predators can abuse 200 plus times and never be caught if the abuse is never disclosed. Another type of offender is an opportunist offender. Quite often, these do not go through the grooming process. They act impulsively and see an opportunity to abuse a child and take it. These offenders often involve immediate or extended family or children that are well known to them. Some of them still invest in the grooming, but quite often they use physical force to subdue a victim if necessary. When choosing a victim, a predator actually has a process that they go through. Quite often they will choose children who they can prey on with no fear of disclosure. They look to fulfill a role as a parent figure or a confidant of the child. They have regular access to and are trusted to be alone with the child. They also look for children who are uneducated about body safety and abuse. What I mean by that is if an adult or an abuser goes to a child and starts touching them and the child tells them to stop, that I know this is wrong, my mom told me not to let anybody touch my private parts, quite often the abuser will leave that child be and will go find another victim. They're not going to keep going back to a child that they know that knows what they're doing is wrong. They also look for children that trust them and may love them because then they're less likely to disclose abuse. They also look for children who they have power and authority over, a child who is seeking attention and especially loving attention and affection. They also look for children who they can communicate secretly with so that they're not caught. Why do abusers choose children? No two predators are alike in thoughts or drive as to why they would choose a child. However, abusers quite often have an unchecked sense of entitlement and power, and that they need to prove that they're above others and have a right to do whatever they want without reproach. There's also a sense of excitement and satisfaction that comes from the grooming process. The grooming process is not only to subdue the child, but it's also to trick the people around them. So during the grooming process, they go through a stage, and it's actually to get the adults to trust the perpetrator rather than the child. Most often, perpetrators also have low self-esteem. They have stress, unmet emotions, no needs for intimacy and affection, and they use sexual gratification with the child as a way to cope. Most of them are also sexual deviant and have a desire to explore a variety of experiences, and they may exhibit this through a child rather than trying to fulfill their needs through a relationship with a person. Most of perpetrators are also socially isolated. Some of them are considered loners, eccentric, often or awkward, and don't socialize well with others. They choose children because they're less threatening than approaching an adult. However, this also does not mean that all socially awkward people will become offenders. The grooming process is actually a process that may take more than just a week or a month. Quite often it may take years before an offender will actually perpetrate on a child. Grooming is done in public, so people are less likely to be suspicious of their behavior. If adults aren't suspicious, it creates a false sense of security with the child, because then, well, mom and dad like this person, so therefore it's okay if I go alone with this person somewhere. They don't see the consequences of what it might lead to, because if my parents trust them, well, then I should trust them too. Perpetrators during the grooming process, they don't always act abusive in front of others. Quite often they act loving, helpful, charming, and attentive, so that they can convince that other adults that, well, this child must be crazy. Why would I ever do something like that? In close-knit communities, quite often grooming is very limited, as trust towards adults is expected and automatic. So that's right away one step to the advantage of a perpetrator, because if adults are respected, then the child is automatically questioned if they come forward with abuse. In cases of sexual abuse where it involves families, especially parents and siblings, grooming is quite often not necessary at all. There's 7 stages to the grooming process. The first one is to identify and target a victim. Any child or teen can be a potential victim. Some perpetrators are attracted to a certain characteristics or may target children with coexisting factors such as vulnerable parents. The next one is gaining victims' trust. A perpetrator will often observe a child and assess their vulnerabilities to best learn how to approach and interact with them. They also offer special attention, understanding, and engage them in ways that gain trust and friendship. They look for their likes and dislikes and cater to them so they're easier to approach. They also fill a need. A perpetrator may manipulate a relationship so that it appears that they are the only ones that understand the child, and then they're able to meet their needs and basically pull the child away from their parents or other trusted adults so that they can prove that, well, I understand you, your mom has no clue what you're going through, so they can perpetrate easily. The next thing they do is they isolate the child, they offer a child rides, they take them places, they pull them away from a group of people and will take them on their own. Not all abuse, however, happens in secrecy. So even though they try to isolate a child, quite often abuse happens in front of other people as well. It's not impossible to happen. Then they create secrecy around a relationship. A perpetrator may reinforce the connection they have with a child when they're alone and strengthen it with admonitions of not telling anyone because no one will believe them, or don't tell anybody because your parents will be unhappy with you, and if you tell on me, nobody's going to believe you. Quite often they will also include threats in this, threats of suicide, threats of killing or harming the child, or taking away something that is special to the child, therefore keeping the child secret even longer. Then they sexualize the relationship. Quite often they use power over a child to establish an emotional connection through coercion and other tactics. This begins with non-sexual touching, and quite often they test their limits with that and then gradually increase it and sexualize the relationship more. This desensitizes the child over time because a child has a hard time of looking at a relationship and, well, he touched my knee today, tomorrow it's my thigh, then it's further up, and now I'm a victim because he touched my private parts. Quite often they don't discern that there's a difference between them, and just automatically, as the perpetrator advances their abuse, it changes the child's comfort zone. After that, they maintain control through secrecy and keep it going to make sure that the child doesn't disclose abuse. Children are quite often afraid to disclose abuse because the perpetrator may have told them they wouldn't be believed or that the child did something that made the perpetrator abuse them. The child may also feel shame or fear of being blamed for the abuse. Some of the red flags to keep be aware of during the grooming process are if a child is getting extra attention to build a friendship, to make them feel special, it might not always be noticeable, but if someone is reaching out to spend extra time with your child, just be aware of who it is and what they're doing. Some activities such as tickling, wrestling, hugging, and kissing may seem innocent, but quite often it is with an ulterior motive. Not always, but just be aware. Quite often what starts is accidentally touching a child's private parts to see how they will react increases to more, just to test for a reaction, not only from a child, but also from a parent. They also have a lack of respect for privacy. What this means is if a child is in the bathtub, quite often, even if they're old enough to take a bath on their own, if someone purposely goes into the bathtub room to sit on the toilet and talk to them while they're taking a bath, that is one thing to be aware of because it's not giving a child privacy that they need. Another thing to be aware of is making inappropriate or sexual comments or jokes to the child or about the child in front of others, giving gifts for no apparent reasons, spending more time with children than with adults to the point of it being odd. And another thing to be aware of is testing a child's reaction to affectionate touching. This includes long hugs, kissing, not necessarily kissing on the cheek, but kissing on the mouth, even when it's not a relationship where that would normally happen. One of the more common types of abuse lately is abuse by children. 40 to 70% of abuse is perpetrated by an older or more physically, mental, or mentally advanced child. Sibling sexual abuse falls under this category, and it is actually the most common type of child-on-child abuse, and it is also the most underreported and the most devastating to children and to families. 7 out of 8 juvenile offenders of sexual abuse are at least 12 years old. 93% of them are male, and the average victim age is 6 years old, and the average age of a perpetrator is 15. This type of abuse is done by a more knowledgeable child who will exploit or a naive or less knowledgeable child. A lot of times this is mistaken for sexual curiosity. Some actions that are considered abuse are when abuse happens more than one or two times. If it's a sibling on sibling, for sure, quite often it happens over a span of years and happens on a very regular basis. If there's an age difference of 2 to 3 years, quite often that is enough for it to be considered abuse. Most perpetrators know that what they're doing is wrong, and it is not sexual exploration. They know very well what they're doing, and they're doing it for power and for control over the person they're, or the child they're abusing. There's quite often sexual behavior that is age appropriate when it's considered abuse, when it falls outside of what is normal for a child, and then it becomes sexual abuse as well. This also involves an abuse of power to manipulate and use other forms of abuse to control the victim. Quite often, physical abuse and emotional abuse are also used to control a juvenile offender. Childhood perpetrators of abuse are quite often ones that have experienced or witnessed abuse, or are most likely resorting to abusing another child as a way of acting out, as a cry for help. Most of them have access to porn and are addicted to porn. They have a lack of proper sexual education. They're victims of physical abuse or neglect. This means they are either emotionally abused by their parents or other adults. Most of them have poor performance in school, underdeveloped social skills. They're socially isolated from other kids their age, and they have a difficult time with emotional regulation. Another factor is, quite often, they come from a home with unhealthy family dynamics. Most perpetrators, juvenile perpetrators, do not continue to offend as an adult, depending on the age when they first perpetrate their abuse. If they are perpetrating as a younger preteen, quite often, once the abuse stops, they no longer perpetrate. However, if they start in their later teen years, quite often they also go on to be perpetrators as adults as well. Some of the reason for childhood offenders is they do not think of the consequences before they abuse. Adult offenders follow a system. They have the grooming process. And while it's not a one step to another process, it's a cycle. Teenagers don't have that because teenagers don't have the brain capacity to think of cause and effect like an adult does. Their brains aren't fully developed, so they don't always think of this when they offend. They also don't have the brain capacity to plan and reason and problem solve to carry out their abuse. Most of them just act on what they want, what they see, and they use it as a way of control. Due to the nature of the abuse they perpetrate, they're actually more receptive to treatment rather than adult offenders. If a juvenile offender is caught in the act and they get treatment right away, 95 to 98% of them have a success rate of treatment and don't go on to offend again. This does not mean they will go on to lead a normal life, however. Most juvenile offenders later become addicted to other things in life: pornography, drugs, alcohol, gambling, etc. They also have an inability to control their emotions, especially anger. Sibling sexual abuse can spread quickly due to this because what a child sees is normal, so the abuse that happened to them, they see it as normal. And if it's normal for them, they will go on to do it to their cousin, do it to their younger sibling, and it doesn't stop. It becomes a repetitive cycle of abuse that just follows through the years and follows through the generations. They don't know the difference that normal does not mean it's right and okay to do. Some of the motivators for juvenile offenders are, the first one is curiosity, going too far. If they don't have a lack of education about sexual abuse and about proper sexual behaviors and proper sexual activity, or if they are exposed to pornography, quite often that is when they offend. Another factor is if children have experienced abuse or if they were exposed to abuse at an especially young age, they may struggle to cope with their emotions because they might not know that it was wrong, and they act out on their urges to abuse another child as a result. Children that aggressively abuse are quite often also exposed to physical violence, and even if they know that what they're doing is wrong, they act anyway. It's not about curiosity, but more about control and domination to counteract their feelings of low self-esteem and self-worth. Sexual deviancy is another motivator. Most children exhibit signs of sexual addiction or unhealthy sexual activity, and access to porn can actually exacerbate this obsession. Peer-on-peer abuse, which is dating, is also another factor, and most of this is coercion to have sex. Sexting, the idea comes from sexual media that sex is just a casual interaction and it's okay. They don't see any sexual relationship as a gift of God that belongs in a married couple. It's more of a, I want this and I should have it and I should have it now. Some of the Abuse causes complex emotions in victims. Quite often, victims are afraid to discuss the trauma they went through, and although they might want to disclose their abuse due to the pain and anguish and shame that's associated with being abused, especially being abused by a sibling, they don't disclose their trauma. There's also fear of how others will react, especially parents, how they will respond to what they went through, and they will even fear the blame more than they fear the abuse itself. They also fear how people will respond when abuse is disclosed. It's not just parents, but what if someone else finds out I was abused? They also look at fear of the continuing abuse over the fear over what happened if the abuse is disclosed. They fear interrogation. When abuse is disclosed, quite often victims are questioned over and over. Are you sure this happened? Are you sure you remember this correctly? And no victim, especially as a child, wants to relive that. It is traumatizing for them, and they would rather keep silent and deal with it on their own than be questioned over and over. They also fear having a perpetrator chosen or believed over them. There's confusion over if they wanted the abuse to happen, so they don't say anything because, well, maybe I am partly to blame. There's also uncertainty to if it actually was abuse, because most children, especially if they are uneducated, don't know what abuse even is. They don't know that it's wrong. They might feel weird to them, but if they don't know and are never told something is wrong, they don't know to speak up. There's also the fear of being blamed for tearing apart a family, especially if sibling abuse is disclosed, so they don't say anything. All of these fears lead to silence. So how can sexual abuse be prevented, especially sibling sexual abuse? The biggest part is to educate your children about their bodies as young toddlers and to continue throughout childhood. Get help for if your child has been abused, not only the child that was abused, but also the perpetrator. Also be aware of what your children have access through technology. We hope to talk more about this in our second part of our topic, so this is all I'm going to say on this for now. Due to human nature, sexual abuse will never be completely abolished. However, we can take certain steps to ensure that we have the tools to teach our children about it enough in hopes that they will never have to experience it. We hope to cover more information on this, as well as how to respond to and report allegations of sexual abuse, and how abuse can affect a person long-term in the second part of our topic, which we hope to have, Lord willing, in March. At this time, we'd like to take a break. If you guys have any questions, you can text them to the number that is in your pamphlet, or there is a box by the door. 15-minute break, sound good? And then come back and we will answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.